welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, Paul. Paul, did you realize that when this show goes live next week, we will have been in some kind of quarantine for 10 to 12 weeks?
Wow. Yeah. Didn't think it's that long. It seems longer sometimes.
It is. And it's going longer. Now, for those few of us that are old and introverted, this has not been all that difficult of a time. But I think of so many others, you know, people with kids or couples in relationships that are not so good or not so pleasant or even worse. What about those tragic occurrences of abusive homes, man? You know, Paul, I can't imagine. My heart genuinely goes out for those folks.
Forcing people to be together. Well, and everything. Alcoholism's up, drug abuse is up, all kinds of abuse is up because people are under pressure and they're in a pressure cooker.
Under pressure in a pressure cooker. That's a good way to put it. But, you know, given that, I think on the other hand, the majority of us, I have this feeling, and Terry and I are going to talk about it, I have this feeling this time of quarantine is more like a gross inconvenience than anything else. I mean, sure, I miss my sushi, my movies, my museums, and only God knows when those will return, and who knows if a sushi bar will ever be back. But those are the kinds of issues we're facing now, aren't they? Only God knows, certainly not our country leaders, who are forced to function with no guidelines, no precedents, just sort of making it up as they go along. And surely, as I'm looking at it, and I read Terry's blog, I came away with this idea that we are navigating with no map. So today in our conversations in quarantine, I want to chat about these thoughts with my dear friend and compatriot, Terry Hershey. Terry and I, in this show, will play by the same rules that our politicians are playing by, and that's no map or no agenda, and it's not just our politicians, it's our whole country and the whole world. Only we'll just be in conversation like two guys sitting with two beers, except my beer will be a sparkling water. So onward, without any, as they say, further ado, let's bring on Terry. Yo, Hirsch, what's up, man?
Hi, Charles. And my beer is not a sparkling water.
What kind are you drinking?
IPA, the same kind that Jesus drank.
Maybe, you know, there's probably in one of the sub-gospels that he had... He had vases for, or vases or whatever they call them, containers that he made beer as well as wine.
Well, yeah. They would have had to do something with yeast, right? With yeast, I'm sure.
Yeah. I know, boy, we're really off track, but I know I was reading in when I was attending a Baptist ceremony that they talked about, or Baptist seminary. They talked about when they could not find wine for Eucharist, they were using beer because not the Baptist seminary was not in favor of that, but that was what many foreign countries used because alcohol was essential in the communion. So I always thought that was interesting.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that is interesting.
So
I didn't listen to, I'll be straightforward with you. I didn't listen to your introduction. So what are we talking about?
Navigating with no map.
Oh.
So you obviously didn't read my little email to you.
Well, that's interesting because I don't, you think there's really no map?
Well, I'm just going by your blog.
I'm saying a lot of people think there's no map, but internally we do have a map, I would say. That's what I would argue.
Well, then argue it.
Well, did you, in my blog, the story I told about the family from China?
Yes.
So it's a real story. The family, they were missionaries in the People's Republic of China, and when Mao came into power, everyone was kicked out, and Western people were kicked out. And it wasn't like you had. And I was talking to my you know, my friends who were Kilborns. They were missionaries in Korea when they were kids. Same thing happened in Korea. So he was saying, yeah, that happened to us. So they're kicked out, but they're told they don't. It's not like you're kicked out in a week or 2 weeks. Literally, today, you're kicked out. But you're allowed to take X number of weight of whatever your stuff is. In other words, you can't take everything.
You said 200 pounds, didn't you?
200 pounds. So this is a story about the Adsit family. There's a mom and a dad and two kids. So they have the family discussion about who gets to take what. Because I can imagine that'd be a discussion for any of us. Which is really kind of the, that's our map. Who gets to take what? So they come up with it, and they got the 200 pounds, literally, to the pound, 200 pounds. And so they're glad, good, we made it. So they're at the border to be kicked out, to leave. And the guard says, you ready? Yes. Do you have your 200 pounds? Yes. And then the guard says, did you weigh the children? And they said, excuse me? And he said, weigh the children. So there's two things about that. One is that somewhere internally, there's something to weigh the children means there's something that all of us defer to at some level that is significant, essential, important, vital. On the other hand, there's a part of us that just accumulates 200 pounds, not knowing what is essential or vital or necessary. So at that level, yes, we may not have a quote map because we just take our 200 pounds. But if we stop, if we pause, there are some things deep down that should guide us when we make our choices, our decisions.
What would that be, Terry? What would the guidelines or the guiding factors or our guide tell us are essential?
Eddie Hillison. Do you know that name, Eddie Hillison?
I sure do not.
Yeah, Eddie, she was a young woman. She, Jewish, she was, caught up in Hitler's Germany and imprisoned, et cetera. But she was very loquacious in her writing, and it's interesting the kind of stuff she wrote and journaled while she was, I was about to say in quarantine. Well, she was prisoned, but that's about the same thing. Only with far more dire impact, I would think.
Yeah.
But one of the things she wrote, because she was quite loquacious, one of the things she wrote, she said, ultimately, we have just one moral duty. She said, to reclaim large areas of peace in ourselves. More and more peace in ourselves. And from there, to reflect that toward others. Because as there is more peace in us, there will be more peace available to our troubled world. So I don't know. I'm thinking out loud with you as I'm going through this because I'm asking the question, if I were weighing the children, what are those things? And so I get what she's saying. At my core, is this Terry at peace? Because if I am, I'm able to make decisions and choices that are not pulled in so many directions. I don't need to impress. I don't need to please. I don't need to. I don't need to curry favor. It comes from a place that is already grounded. You know. There's an enoughness to it. That who I am is enough. And it's interesting when you come to a place of internal peace where who you are is enough. So many things you don't need. You don't need to accumulate stuff. You don't need extra noise. You don't need to do something to impress somebody else. There's so many things you don't need, which is amazing. So you're at a place, of calm.
I so agree. I have for a long time now, and especially these current days, been a strong advocate of peace. And I think I brought up one time
internal peace. Yeah.
And internal peace. Do you know in the Bible the only word, the only noun in the New Testament used more than peace is love? Love is used over 600 times. Peace is used over 400 times. How many times have you heard sermons on love? And then how many times have you heard sermons on peace? And peace is really so much, not only, certainly we're looking for love, but we're looking for peace. We're looking for some kind of reconciliation with ourselves, and that we are in a state of mind or in a state of place of ultimate contentedness. And we need not stuff. We necessarily don't even always need relationships other than, you know, the mystics would say our relationship with the divine. But it is striking to me that peace is so important.
I agree with you about the relationship part, because the thing about enoughness, and I call it enoughness, contentment you call it, but enoughness. In other words, I'm at home in my own skin. And if I'm at home in my own skin, there's an interesting thing going on, because I'm not anxious about what I'm missing. You know? And if I'm anxious about what I'm missing, then when I am in a relationship, I'm actually looking for them to do something I don't have, or to make me somebody I'm not.
Yeah, I'm pondering, because that is so true. And I think, you know, not to pick on your vocation, but I think as a public speaker, that's really important as a public speaker, because you're looking for something for the crowd, from the crowd, for validation of your existence. Some kind of response from that crowd. Now, not everybody does that, and I think to a large degree you have graduated from that, but certainly in the beginnings of public speaking, it really is about pleasing other people, adulation for ourselves, appreciation for ourselves, and those are all the wrong reasons. Those are creating sort of a non-tangible but emotional or psychological baggage that gets in the way of the kind of peace that we're looking for.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And I remember, not necessarily the day per se, but I remember when that finally happened to me, you know, as a speaker. Because you're standing on the stage and you're waiting for that, quote, feedback.
Right.
Because I haven't, this is going back to the map, I haven't really, the first thing is, are you at peace in your core? Are you enough? Let's start there. That's really my number one. This is a phenomenal story. It's not my story. Tara Brach, who's a writer, she wrote about this.
Right.
Anyway, but a man named Jacob, who 70 mid stages of Alzheimer's. Anyway, he was a quote somebody. He was a clinical psychologist, a mediator, a speaker. He was all these things for years. But with all mid stage, you know, Alzheimer's, you know, all his, you know, the faculties he had were deteriorating. And now there are times when his mind goes in and out, so to speak. But his spirit's still good. But anyway, so Tara had asked Jacob to help.
Now let's just give an idea, Tara. She's kind of very huge in the meditation.
Correct. Right. Correct. And mindfulness and so forth.
Right. Mindfulness and meditation.
Yeah. So she interviewed him at this retreat, and she says to him, how is it that you can be sort of accepting of your disease? And he said, because it doesn't feel like anything is wrong with me. I like that. I feel grief and fear about everything going on, but it's still real life. And so he told the story at this retreat when he was in the earlier stages of the disease, and he was still giving talks on Buddhism. And, you know, one occasion there's like 100 people who are coming to this thing. It's a full thing. They're all meditation people. They're waiting for the expert, right? And he confessed. He said he looked out and he realized, I don't know what to say to them. I don't even know how to draw it up in me. And so he just said, I don't remember why I'm here or what I'm here for. I don't know. So he said, his mind spinning, you know. But he said, I just sat, put my palms together, and all he did was named out loud what was happening inside of him. And so his speech was this: afraid, embarrassed, confused, feeling like I'm failing, powerless, shaking, sense of dying, sinking, lost. And then he lifted his head and apologized to the audience. He said, but most of them were in tears. Because they said, no one's ever taught us like this. And I'm
that is so true, because we treat, you know, especially in Western world, you know, it seems like some sort of ecstatic involvement or passionate involvement or involvement in service of other people or involvement in service of family. You know, they're so action oriented, and they're not based sort of on a reality that transcends all of those things and finds its pleasure and its essence in solitude and acceptance and peace, oneness, you know, in my studies that I'm doing now, oneness with the divine, and which, you know, I feel miserably at, but in my midst of failure, there are moments of insight that are just utterly delectable and worth the rest of it. But we, you know, we're looking outward rather than internally at this point. I would like to go back to Terry's question, because Terry sort of didn't quite get the idea that I wanted to talk about navigating with no map. And I think this pandemic there really is no map. We have no idea what the beginning nor the end is. People are thinking we're beginning to reopen. I have this feeling that we are just at the early stages of the pandemic, and we have no idea of what is going to come of it. And in doing so, I have this compassion for our country's leaders who pretend, at least to the public, I don't know if they pretend to themselves, but they pretend to the public that they have some sort of keen insight into what needs to be done. But there just is not enough science. There is not enough data. We have no idea what a recurring second wave will look like if we open up too quickly. If we don't open up quickly enough, what's the damage to the economy? It is, you know, I've never wanted to be a politician, but never have I not wanted to be a politician more than today. Because it is, don't you think, Terry, it's navigating without a map? We don't, there's no good rules. There's no guidelines. There's no precedents.
Oh, that's different. To say there's no precedent would be only partly true, because There was a pandemic 100 years ago. So in other words...
Yeah, but we don't have the data that really can help us.
Actually, they do.
Not good data.
Yeah, but I'm saying, yeah, there's no precedent for this virus. There's no doubt about that. And in fact, different countries are handling it in different ways. That's exactly true. But to say that there's no map, and this is just me talking personally, I had a position of leadership, honestly, I would say, the map is, I can tell you, I don't know if this data will stand. I don't know. I can't tell you for certain if this is where we will be in a week, a month, a year. I cannot tell you. Here's what I can tell you. Here's what I do know. However, the big thing for me, map-wise, is here's what we will commit to, and here's what we will hold to be sacred and true.
But doesn't there have to be, in order to know what we're going to commit to and sacred and true, doesn't that predispose some sort of end in mind?
The end in mind in terms of what we do as a country, or what?
Well, if we have a map, you know, a map sort of gives us an idea of what's going to go on in the journey and where the journey begins and where the journey ends, and we have... no idea of that. In my mind, we have no idea of that. We only know step by step on this journey, sort of Frodo's exploits. He had no idea where he was going.
Let's go this way. At one level, I can say I do not know. I may never. I'm speaking as Charlie Hedges now. I may never get to go to a San Diego Padres game again in my life. Literally. I may watch my son from my living room, and he'll be good, and I'll be cheering him on. He won't hear me, but that's fine. In other words, there are things I may never do again. Yes, there's no map for that. I wholeheartedly agree. However, the we we're speaking of is not necessarily what I get to do physically or what I'm enabled to do in terms of where I get to fly, shop, etc. I may never. As a person who flies for a living for my job, that's what I do. I may never. Sure, there's no map for that. I may never. However, I have to distill it down, Charlie, because in order to handle all that kind of information and to help people who read my stuff handle it for their life, I may never get to have a wedding again where there's lots of people or perform it. I may perform it through Zoom. In other words, there's a lot of I may nevers. However, there is a map in terms of, however, there are ways that I will treat the people who are closest to me. That's fundamental. That's non-negotiable. There are ways I will treat my own personal health and welfare and sanity. That's a non-negotiable. There are ways I will reach out to people who are going through unbelievable hell right now. In other words, I don't know what that list is, but there are a few of them that are just non-negotiables. That's a map. In other words, whatever decisions I do make have to be... All I'm saying is I don't disagree with you that I don't know lots of stuff, but in order to make decisions about the stuff I don't know, there's stuff I have to believe in about the human experience. And the fact that not one of us is on the journey alone. That's a non-negotiable to me. That's a map.
You know what I'm saying, and I don't want to get too deep into a metaphor because you always get really messed up when you get too deep in a metaphor, but it sounds to me like you're redefining the territory of the traditional map. The traditional map had predetermined spaces on it, predetermined goals, predetermined directions, and now we have none of those. What we have are deeply character and relational involved territories. That these territories, which they should have always been, are about people, not about places and things.
Yes, that's the reconnection. And to that point about maps, which is interesting, if you look at any old maps of the globe and or of countries, most of them very early on were not just wrong, but I mean they were knew they what they thought they knew, but they were inaccurate in a play in a way that was detrimental. In other words, they had to learn the map as they went. But underneath that is what you're saying is that, and what I'm saying too is that, however, there are things I need to commit myself to as I'm learning how to draw that other map. I don't know necessarily where the land hits the sea, per se. But I have to commit to certain things about who we are as people as we're trying to draw the land and the sea. That's a big deal.
That's really insightful, Hirsch. That's if I had room up, excuse me. If I had room on my desk, I'd be taking notes because that is that's very insightful. Because ideally, those excuse me, I swallowed wrong. Because those maps are the essential maps, are not relational maps, love maps, caring maps, maps of kindness and compassion. Are those not much more vital maps than maps of where my career is going to lead, how long this coronavirus is going to get back before I can have sushi again? That's not so important. That's the maps that I have for caring for people and dealing with people.
You're thinking about kindness is the same thing, and I'm thinking, you know, in terms of our own past, in terms of clergy for religious organizations and institutions, and you know they go along the complete gamut of conservative to liberal, et cetera. But many of them can be different, as in, for example, I'm not a conservative, but many of them can be very conservative religious people, and so the way they draw their map as a theology is going to be different than my map. However, they will still base it on those same essentials: kindness, empathy, compassion, connection.
Hopefully.
Exactly. Yeah, but you know, you get my point. My point is there's something more fundamental than drawing where the land meets the sea.
Yeah.
And every single one, I mean, look around the globe right now. Every single country is trying to draw where the land meets the sea relative to COVID, relative to pandemic, relative to how it gets passed. I mean, we're learning the data. We're learning the data, and the people who are good at it are learning it. However,
yeah, but the data is still so incomplete. Even the ones learning it really don't know, from what I've read, don't know that much anyway. I mean, they know a hell of a lot more than they did to begin with. It's nothing about
as anybody who's in that business should, with humility, say we're learning it. However, there is those fundamental things that we weigh the children of empathy. We weigh the children with compassion. We weigh the children with connection, connectedness. I mean, the pronoun we is far more profound now to me than the pronoun I. And anytime the pronoun I is used, then we're drawing the map the wrong way.
You know what's really interesting, and this is probably interesting to me only and not necessarily as much to our listeners, but as I have taken this two or three months to really investigate and ponder and try to live into the mystic and the mystical traditions and contemplative prayer, is there is a great communal aspect to it. It is not just me. It is a community. It is a community that is in relationship with the divine. And we are part of this community, and that we are responsible to our relationship with the divine, but even more so, we're responsible to our relationship with the community in general human communion.
Yeah, and let me say this, Charlie, because what I like about what you said there is that, And because I know the kind of people you read, and they're from different centuries. They're not even from the same time zone, per se.
No.
In other words, so whenever they lived, whoever was drawing where the land met the sea with regard to God, with regard to life, they had difference of opinions. But isn't it interesting that along the way, they still drew on the same well of the essentials? That communal aspect
from a theosophic perspective.
Well, from the fact that here's what we start with. Here's what we do know. The divine is in us, and we are in the divine.
Right. That is the essence of the mystical.
You may be unbelievably clueless about life, and you may be an idiot, but the divine is in you. So we're going to start there.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I don't want to get into it, but it's beautiful text. I'm so enamored with these texts. You know, I'm reading Teresa of Avila now, and she's just...
Oh, well, yeah, it was her saint day just recently, so...
Was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, she's remarkable.
Speaking of quarantined, I mean, she was... in all kinds of shutdown pain.
Oh, my goodness. You know, I talked about Teresa, you know, who is, you know, perhaps one of, you know, the top five saints in relationship with God of all the saints. And she went 20 years in the convent, hated praying, was correct, looking for the clock to end because she could find no relationship with God. And then out of... you know, some circumstance, God chose to reveal himself to her. But she went 20 years. She said she was counting the clock, waiting for the clock to end so she could get out of her prayer sessions and go do something. She was 40 years old before she had ever really had a genuine encounter with God. And she was 50 years old when she met St. John of the Cross, that sort of changed both of their
directions. She was sort of his mentor, I think, wasn't she?
Yes, yeah. She absolutely was. Yeah. He was imprisoned for following her. He was imprisoned for following her reform. Was in a jail cell, tortured, and prayed, and had these ecstatic relationships with God. But during this time of imprisonment and torture, God would not answer him. And then all of a sudden, God answered him in the darkness of his soul. And then he wrote the great book, The Dark Night of the Soul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, so it's interesting about that is that back to your theme about maps, per se, that, I mean, I really do think, I mean, I talk about mine was the enoughness part and yours is some of the things you talk about with them, but if I do pay attention to those things, if I can name them, then the constraints of wherever I am now, and in your language, the prison walls do not confine me. A pandemic does not confine, not confine me in the sense of where I go, but in terms of my emotional well-being. Yes, things can be shitty and uncomfortable, but it doesn't name my reality.
Yeah, that was, you know, it's interesting that you would say this. I'm reading from Teresa right now as I'm looking up in some of my notes. And Teresa writes, "Know that you are perfect and that you are enough and that you are absolutely nothing."
Yeah. Yeah, because you don't need to be somebody to be enough. That's the best part is here. I know there's a pandemic going on, but here, let me show you my resume.
Yeah, I like your idea with no map. I think that there's sort of double entendre there. There is a map that is about how the leadership should manage, and they have no map and they have no idea how to manage. But then there is a map that goes, that transcends the leadership. And I like the way you had put it earlier this morning, that you had put one of your main goals. Tell me, reframe that, where you were talking about the conditions and safety of other individuals has to be of primary concern for all of us, rather than, and we're going to get into the inconvenienced American, but that those were essential.
Well, yeah, that's the we versus the I. I mean, I here's the thing. So I'm on a ship in 1200, and I've got a map that they gave me about where this sea goes and what country I hit. And we know for a fact now that map was probably wrong.
Right.
But I'm still in charge of that ship, and I still have, quote, the map they gave me. However, if I'm a good captain, I have to govern by other essentials, and one of them is my crew comes before my safety. In other words, I'm a we guy, not an I guy. So in other words, if we come to a place where we are doesn't agree with the map we were given, we will make a choice predicated on we, not upon me.
How common do you think that is among politicians today?
Oh, my Lord. So anyway, I have to go get a drink.
You already finished your beer?
I tell you what, Charlie. And this is a practical answer. My practical answer, because of the way we raise funds for politics, that's the problem. To me, that's just me speaking, is that I'm beholden to all the people who are paying to get me into office.
Right.
And if I wasn't
part of the difficulty
in other words,
of our system.
If I have to ask the question, who's paying the bill, then I'm not going to be able to answer that. See, the thing about the guy at sea, in my analogy, is the people who are, quote, paying for him to be the captain of that ship, which may never come back alive. He's not beholden to anybody right there other than his crew. He's only beholden to the people on his ship.
That sounds to me like democracy.
It sounds to me like it.
Yeah, and instead of self-interest and re-election and all of that other crap.
Well, that's part of the thing, too, is the way we have to do that is that by the time people are elected, they have to start running for office again.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, what I want to do is I want to change tracks on our conversation, and I want to go into from preaching to meddling. So let's take a quick break, and we will come back and get into my next subject if my producer is there. Hi there, this is Charlie Hedges, and you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie, and today is my dear friend, compatriot, Terry Hershey. We are discussing the nature of, during these early days, 2.5 months into quarantine, during these early days of quarantine, because I call them early days because I think we've got a long way to go, that we are navigating without a map, and by my interpretation, a map is sort of directional, and Terry's map is sort of intentional, that has to do with human's condition, and if we're a captain on a ship, our ship is not our destination, but it is the way we treat our people and the way we encourage our people. Would you consider that an apt wrap-up, Terry?
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Okay, good. So what I want to do now is I want to go to, like I said, from preaching to meddling, and this will get us into some political controversy, which I know you are dying to get into, and I'm sure when Paul hears it, he's going to divide, you know, chomping at the bits to get his two cents in. But I've used this quote every week, I think, since you gave it to me. But it is so, when I see these protests out here, and of protests at wanting their human rights, this is against the Constitution, and believe me, I understand them. I get where they're coming from in this, but I feel like there's something amiss in it. And there are so many of us that are in the middle of this that are not on either side of hyper quarantine nor totally relaxed quarantine. But you told me a quote that you heard that I really resonated, and that was, hell hath no wrath like an inconvenienced American. And I stated early on, you didn't hear this. You said, in spite of all of the difficulties that we're facing, and I'm looking for my quote. Let me find my quote. Oh, on the other hand, in addition to the people that are really going through suffering in quarantine, I think for the majority of us, this time of quarantine is more like a gross inconvenience than it is anything else. Like, but sure, I miss my sushi, my movies, my museums, and only God knows when they will return, if a sushi bar ever returns. But those are inconveniences for me. Those are not matters of essential nature. And it's inconveniences, and it's a failure to discover or garner my stuff that pleases me, and I can't get that in this time of quarantine. Quarantine really forces us to consider what is truly necessary. What would you say? Now, this is a tough question that I've not asked you to prepare for, but what would you say are the genuine needs, or the human needs, or the basic needs of a human being during this time of quarantine? And also, it's really not just during this time of quarantine, but the time of quarantine is making it more prominent in our minds. Did that question make any sense, or was that just too rambling?
Well, I know you well enough to know that it made sense to you.
It didn't make sense to me. What is it that we really need? If we're inconvenienced, and inconvenienced is about, you know, where I get to go and what I get to do, rather than who I get to be to me and to others. What are the needs that you see?
I was on a flight once, and I got off the flight, and everybody's on their phone, you know, their mobile device. And we were late 45 minutes or something, getting wherever we were going. And this, you know, this is my life. I'm busy. I'm active. I've got to do, et cetera. And we were first class. We were flying first class. I was in first class. He was in first class. But we're off the plane first. And I can hear him on his phone, and he's apoplectic and dropping F-bombs and how late they are, and he's going to maybe be late to the meeting, miss the meeting, et cetera. And he said, this whole flight was an effing disaster. And I actually laughed. I started to laugh because I thought to myself, this is the world I live in, that I get to walk off of a plane sitting in first class and say that because I'm late, it's an effing disaster. And I went through in my mind places I know in the world, times I know in the world, where suffering was unimaginable. But I, because I'm late for a meeting, it's an effing disaster. I'm not discounting any pain people feel. I have my readers whose spouse is in Alzheimer's care, and they can't visit them because of the quarantine. I have that. I have people who lost their income. I have all of these things that people tell me that is real life. I get that. But we have no clue about effing disaster. And I need to just chill out and start with, okay, it might be a disaster, and as far as I know, it's effing. But the deal is this. Do you love someone, and are you loved? And if that is true, can you start there? And if you can't see them, can you at least Zoom them or call them and tell? Because if that is true, start there. So before you go on a march and yell at somebody and piss off somebody else, would you at least start with that one? Start there. And the person you love, are you there for their well-being? Start there. And that person you love and whatever they're going through, are you there for that to happen? And for the fact that you're able to even tell them, are you grateful? There's a whole litany of stuff that I have to go through before I have any right to march about anything that I'm inconvenienced about. There you go. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, and I have to give an example of yesterday. I was going through some of my old writings, and that largely 2006 to 2008, and was very pleased with many of the writings. But I came upon an internet exchange that I put on a Word document, and I kept in the Word document. And it was with my previous assistant when I was developing tools for women of faith. And, you know, we had this online business. And this young woman, she's 20 years younger than me. As I read the letter, I realized she really, Terry, this woman got me, really understood me deep inside. We were soulmates, and I would spend time. And it was not romantic. It wasn't anything. You know, we didn't cross any boundaries of male and female relationship. Yet it was a genuine, loving, wonderful relationship. And she was so encouraging to me. She would keep me going in my journey. And I had to call her yesterday. She lives in Michigan now. And I had to call her just to tell her, Jay, this, you know, I just was reading our relationship, reading notes of our relationship, and it was so meaningful, and it was just so, so utterly delightful to remind myself of what a kindred spirit was and what a soulmate was. And I was able to, and we just engaged in that, and she felt likewise. And, you know, she's married with two just utterly delightful children. And yet we could talk about things of the past that are continuing to be present, even though we really haven't talked for 5 or 6 years. But that just kind of reinforces what you said, is what was invaluable as a person, one person to another person. And those are the things that makes us human.
I agree. Does it make us human? Does it make me more human or less human?
Yeah. Yeah, human, and fully human.
Human, is, by its very nature, is a connectivity. We're connected.
We're connected in multifarious ways. We are connected, yeah, not only with the divine, but we're connected with each other. Just as we are connected with those that don't see things as we see them. You know, there is a connection. There is a human connection that can, when handled it rightly, you know, bring about a sense of peace and grace, and not agreeing with them, and not promoting their ideas, but understanding that that's their ideas, that's where they are right now. And I think we could just use a lot more of that. I wrote a post on patience, and you know, I'm sort of center of the road, leaning a bit more left, but I believe in patience, and I believe in the vitriol and name calling and finger pointing just does us no good. how ideally if our officials could work together with a we together than an me you situation, how much better off we would be. And I really liked your image of a captain on a ship. The captain on a ship has a map, but his primary map is his crew. What is the health of the crew? What is the health? And if our leaders looked at their job as captain on ships and looked at what are the values and the needs of my crew, of my shipmates, and of the ships that are following us, that would really determine, that would really make for a lot more promising impact on our society rather than how does it make me look? What is my narcissistic sort of need look?
I agree.
Well, Hirsch, as always, it's been a great conversation with you. I look forward to more times. Thank you for spending the time. I know you are gardening, and this was your cocktail hour that you devoted to me. So I thank you.
Yeah. You can rename your podcast The Cocktail Hour Devoted to Me. That's the new.
Well, let's say devoted to our listeners.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good idea. The Cocktail Hour Devoted to You. There you go. You've got it down.
Yeah. Yeah. Not like I'm very important, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. So, Hirsch.
All right, man. Thanks.
Thanks for being on this. I want to encourage everyone to check out your inspirational post, The Sabbath Moment, which can be found at terryhirschy.com. And I also want to thank our listeners for tuning in to The Next Chapter with Charlie. And be sure to check us out at our website, thenextchapter.life. And until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie, right here in Orange County's only community radio station, octalkradio.net.